We want to tell you about a show we think you'll love. Derelict is an immersive sci-fi horror podcast. The story begins at the bottom of Earth's ocean, where an ancient artifact resembling a giant door has just been found. The galaxy's most powerful corporation has built a massive secret laboratory around the door, intending to unlock the secrets of the artifact and discover what lies inside. But some mysteries should remain buried, and some doors should never be opened. The second season, currently releasing, picks up several years after the events of the first, from fathoms below Earth's ocean to the depths of space. If you're a fan of movies like Alien, the works of H.P. Lovecraft, or games like Deep Space and Bioshock, you'll love Derelict. Unravel the mystery and subscribe to Derelict. That's D-E-R-E-L-I-C-T, wherever you listen to podcasts. And after the episode, stay tuned to hear the trailer.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for tuning in for this episode of 13. Before we get started, I want to shout out our new patrons, Thomas Banks II, Nicole Mason, and Sarah Roden. Thank you all so much for your support. If you've ever been curious about joining our pod fam, but you don't know where to start, come check us out over at patreon.com/13pod. We have tiers as low as $1 for folks who just want ad-free main episodes, or $5, which gives you access to extra stories each month, plus over 2 years of our backlog. Just click the link in our show notes to learn more. This month's episode is Scratch, Scratch, Scratch by Serena Dori. Are you ready? Sit back, turn down the lights, and now, on with the show. I didn't believe the stories when I started working at the historic home right after graduating high school. When my coworkers told me about the ghosts, I assumed they were trying to freak me out to get me to quit. The Ermatinger House was built in 1843, one of the first houses constructed after people arrived on the Oregon Trail. As a tour guide, I wasn't supposed to talk about the murders that had happened in the house, or about the former caretaker who had gone insane. I was supposed to give historical facts about Francis Ermatinger, John McLaughlin, and the importance of the Hudson Bay Company. As someone who had sprouted up in Oregon City, I had been bombarded with pioneer history since I was a child. Being a tour guide would help me pay for community college. It should be easy. Well, easy for someone with social skills, anyway. Talking to people was going to be a challenge for me, but I told myself that I could do this. Anything was better than the endless torment I had endured at my previous job. I showed up for my first day of work on a June morning. My boss looked at my corset-style top and torn leggings, also a thrift store plaid skirt, befitting of anyone trying to look stylish in the late 90s. I tried not to squirm under her gaze, already self-conscious in the attire I'd selected. I had determined to give up my baggy sweats and dress like someone worthy of being noticed. Now that I wasn't in high school, it would be easier to fit in and make mature friends who understood me. Bertha's resting gargoyle face pinched up in more disapproval than usual. She told me I was going to be cold in that outfit, I avoided my boss's gaze, intimidated by the formidable woman. "Oh, I thought the house wasn't air-conditioned," I said. There were only two places in the house with electricity. They were the kitchen, with the attached bathroom in the back of the building that had been added on 50 years prior, and the security alarm next to the front door. Bertha glanced up toward the stairwell with a snort.
"The ghosts like young ladies to wear long skirts and long sleeves," she said.
I laughed, assuming that it was a joke, though I was mildly annoyed by the remark. I didn't believe in ghosts. That was for babies. I'd just turned 18. I was determined not to let this woman intimidate me with her thinly disguised contempt. She handed me the keys, reminded me of my cleaning duties, and pointed to the pamphlets for the tour. I had finally made it. After working at the city-run art gallery for 2 years, I finally earned 10 cents more an hour. I would now be working at the Historical Museum. I just had to make sure that my social anxiety didn't mess up this job for me. "Remember," Bertha said, with an ominous warning in her tone, "don't go into the basement. It needs to stay locked at all times." I nodded emphatically. I would be the perfect employee. It was 90 degrees by noon, but the building was as cold as the Arctic. As I read one of my college textbooks, I occasionally heard a little scratch, 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 but I couldn't tell where it came from. No one came all morning, and I was sort of relieved. If people came, that meant I would have to talk to them, and I couldn't imagine anything scarier. I resorted to cleaning duties, which allowed me the privilege of going past the roped-off areas to admire the antiques. The only rooms remotely warm in the house were on the second floor. But even on the second floor, a cold spot lingered in front of one window, like an unwelcome guest. With the direct sunlight streaming in, it should have been warm. As I dusted the phonograph, an ancient telephone box, I had the feeling someone was watching me. I looked out the window to see if it was someone outside, but no one was there. While sweeping, I felt a cramping pain in my abdomen every time I neared one of the broken display boxes with antiques inside. I kept getting an odd image in my head of little silver scissors stabbing into my belly. I imagined a bird's beak with each pulsing stab. Since I wasn't having my period, I just thought this was my imagination making sense of my nervous stomach and my first day jitters. I wiped a quarter inch of dust from a display box. It housed decorative spoons, bottles of 19th century elixirs containing cocaine, and random knickknacks. My eyes fell to a tiny pair of pelican scissors, the blades like that of a bird's beak. My breath caught in my throat. This was what I had been visualizing. I leaned down closer, staring into the case. A little fleck of rust dotted one of the blades. Was that blood? The pain stabbed into my stomach again, and I backed away. I left that room, icy streams of sweat trickling down my back. I was just freaking myself out. I must have somehow seen the pelican scissors before, when I entered the room, and subconsciously worked it into my brain. No customers had come yet, so I locked the door and put up the sign that my previous coworker left me. It said I'd be across the street at the city-run art gallery. I didn't set the alarm at the front door because we only needed to do that at night. The gallery across the street was cozy. In the warm room, as I gazed with envy at each beautiful piece of art on display, I wondered if I would ever be skilled enough to show in this gallery. As someone who planned to be an art major, I dreamed of making my mark on the world with my art. One of the girls who worked at the gallery snuck up from behind and scared me with a boo. I jumped and whirled. Dottie snorted.
Aren't you supposed to be spending time with the ghosts across the street or something?
Dottie had been popular in high school. Not in the cheerleader and homecoming queen crowd, but with the alternative kids. I loved her multicolored hair, flamboyant makeup, and zebra print dress. She was a piece of art in herself, the kind of cool I wanted to be. She smirked when I didn't answer right away. I tried to formulate words, but everything came out wrong.
I was slow. I mean, it was slow. I decided to come over here and take a break.
One of my other former coworkers shouted from the front desk where the register was.
Maybe you're just here because you're spooked by the ghosts.
Mandy was dressed slightly more conservatively than Dottie, but she wore enough dark makeup to resemble a raccoon. I raised my chin in defiance.
I don't believe in ghosts.
I wasn't going to let them try to scare me. Dottie leered down at me.
Have you noticed the ribbons tied on the doorknobs? When I used to give tours, the ribbons would be moved to different doors every day.
I was skeptical of anything she said, but I feigned interest because she was popular and I wanted her to like me. Mandy crossed over to the window.
You have a customer at the door. You better catch them before you lose business.
I ran back over to the historic house, but no one was there. Dottie and Mandy watched me from the window, laughing. Mandy probably just said that to get rid of me. My chest constricted with the pain of the slight. Getting away from the art museum had been the biggest draw of working at the Ermatinger House. I got to be close to the gallery, but I didn't actually have to work with Dottie and Mandy or put up with their torment. Over the following days, I ignored the ribbons that showed up on different doors. Mandy and Dottie had the same keys I did, so it was possible they were playing tricks on me. What was harder to ignore was the feeling of being watched. That prickle of hairs standing on end as my intuition told me that I wasn't alone. But I was far more concerned about the living than the dead. When I gave my first tour, I was a nervous wreck. The second and third tour were just as scary for an introvert. During my second week, as I cleaned at the end of my shift, I heard a little scratch, scratch, scratch. A whispery, almost creaking sound inside the walls. I thought it came from the basement, but I wasn't sure. I left a note for my supervisor, suggesting that there were mice. That was the logical solution, what a mature adult would have concluded. Still, I didn't see any mouse droppings. I didn't want to believe in ghosts. But 3 weeks in, I couldn't dismiss what happened next. I was vacuuming the dining room. The cord stretched across the room from the kitchen, where there was an electrical outlet. I ran over clods of dirt on the rug, trying to break them up so that the vacuum would suck up the dirt. Since there were hardly ever any visitors, I couldn't figure out where all of this dirt had come from. I'd made it all the way to the end of the Victorian dining table when the cord had reached as far as it could. I turned around. A chair had been pulled out from the table. It was in my path. I hadn't pulled it out. I turned off the vacuum, and then I stared at that chair. The silence of the house prickled against my ears. Could I have done it as I'd been vacuuming? gone around it and forgotten. But no, it had been pulled out over the cord. I stared at it, scarcely managing to breathe, when I heard a scratch, scratch, scratch coming from the kitchen. My heart lurched so hard in my chest, I thought I was having a heart attack. My fight or flight kicked in. I suddenly found myself outside, across the street, and in front of the art gallery. With shaky hands, I used my cell phone to call one of my coworkers, someone who also worked for the city, giving historic tours. I blurted out that I was in the Ermatinger house, and a chair moved right behind me when I turned away. I said that it was the ghost. I tried to come up with some kind of logical explanation. And if it wasn't a spirit, that means that someone is in the house. He said that he would be here in 5 minutes. I probably could have called the fire department next door to check the building, but I didn't want to explain to them that it might be a ghost, not an intruder. Raj was the one who trained me before my first day. He worked down the street at the John McLaughlin house. Also, Raj was cuter and closer to my age. When I had gotten the job and told my younger sister how cool it was that I would get to work with Raj, my mom had butted into the conversation.
"You probably aren't his type,"
my mom said gently. She knew Raj's mother and had met him plenty of times. I knew that I was an unmemorable wallflower, but it was even more disheartening that my own family saw it too.
"It isn't about you,"
she said firmly. 5 minutes later, Raj pulled up into the tiny parking lot between the fire department and the Ermatinger house. His red, rusty bucket of a car chugging loudly enough to scare away any intruders. Once he was there, we went inside. The vacuum was running. It had propelled itself into a wall. Raj turned it off. I stared at it in alarm.
"I did not leave the vacuum running."
Raj said that he believed me. He was only 3 years older than I was. He was tall and dreamy and an art major like I was going to be. We'd gone to high school together, and we had so much in common. I was so relieved that he was taking me seriously. We walked around the building, checking the back door that was always locked and the front door that had been unlocked when I ran out. But I hadn't taken my eyes off it, so I knew that no one had left by that door. No one was there. Raj gestured with a wave of his hand at the front door. He asked me if, when I enter the building, did I announce myself?
"What do you mean?"
I asked. He said that when he works this building, he always says,
"Hi, it's me, Raj. I'm just here to give tours today. I hope I'm not intruding."
He gave me a pointed look.
"You need to do this to let the ghosts in the building know who you are and why you're here. We are in their house, after all."
He seemed to be serious about this. I nodded, and I told him that I'd do that next time. He examined the sign-in clipboard and asked how many visitors came today.
"Like visitors from beyond?"
I asked. He chuckled. He meant how many people had I given tours to. I laughed at my awkwardness.
"Oh, just two."
He frowned and said that his house had had five. He said he didn't know if they'd be able to pay us all if it wasn't for the grant money. If tourism doesn't pick up soon, they could change our shifts again and make one person cover both houses. That scared me more than the ghosts. Raj had more seniority. He would end up working at both houses, and I would get pushed back to the art gallery. I would have to endure the endless torment of the mean girls. Raj rubbed at his rakish 5 o'clock shadow. He said that he keeps trying to convince Bertha to do an event, like ghost tours at Halloween or a Ghost of Christmas Past thing, but that she won't go for it. But we need to do something so it isn't so slow. On his way out, Raj stopped in front of the basement. The door was open. The door was never open. It was always locked, always closed. The darkness of the stairs was ominous, the cold air seeming to pass through me in a cloud. It smelled like musty mildew, like most things in Oregon. Raj closed the door and told me to never go down there. The door will lock behind you. He said that the ghosts used to lock the old caretaker of the house down there. He grinned and kept going. He said the city only figured out she was a drug dealer because of how many tours she had going on. He leaned in conspiratorially and told me the ghosts didn't like her. When Raj left to return to the John McLaughlin house where he worked, I finished cleaning and closing up the building for the day. After I put the vacuum away, I heard a little scratch, scratch, scratch coming from the basement door. I couldn't get the incident out of my mind. When I went to bed that night, just as I was falling asleep, I heard a scratch, scratch, scratch coming from inside the walls of my bedroom. Days later, at home during dinner, it was just my parents and me. My younger sister was at her job at the pizza restaurant. I told my recovering Catholic New Age mom and my atheist father about work. My father said nothing. I tried to cross the divide between us with conversation. I heard scratching sounds at the Ermatinger house, and now I keep hearing them in the wall of my bedroom at night. My mother spoke up, worried that the ghosts might have followed me home and wondering aloud whether we should smudge the house with sage. My dad told her to stop feeding me supernatural nonsense. He continued sawing through his bloody steak and asked what evidence I have that ghosts are behind any of this. I told him again about the scratching in the walls. He said that it was wasps in the walls, stabbing a potato with his fork. He told me that if I hear them again, to tell him and he'd call an exterminator. My mother jumped in.
You need an exorcist.
She glanced at my father, as if afraid of what he might say. All he said was that there were no ghosts in the Ermatinger house.
What about the chair that was in the middle of my path?
I asked. That had been proof for me. My father sneered at me, like he couldn't believe my stupidity.
A human did that, he said. One of your friends who works across the street.
I found out Dottie and Mandy had thrown an after-hours party in the museum a few days before. That was where all the dirt had come from. The dirt that I'd been stuck cleaning up. The pain of not being invited blossomed in my chest. The reason I'd applied to work at the historic home in the first place was so that I didn't have to work at the art gallery anymore. I didn't want to work with teenagers who took hour-long breaks, had sex in the children's museum with the boss's son, and refused to do their share of the cleaning. I imagined every stain on that carpet in the art gallery that I had to clean was because of my gross coworkers. I don't know why I wanted their acceptance when I didn't even like them. My dad had provided a reasonable explanation for the chair. It was the most logical conclusion. My coworkers certainly had a motive for trying to get me to quit after I'd threatened to tell our supervisor that they were the ones making messes. But Bertha had never liked me, nor was I dating her son. She probably wouldn't believe me. Telling Bertha had been an empty threat. I wouldn't have dared risk the wrath of the cool kids, even now that I was going into college. I was a complete and utter wimp. After dinner, as I was washing dishes, my mother patted my shoulder. Her voice was barely audible compared to the blast of the television in the other room. She told me that we'd smudge the house after my father falls asleep. I nodded. I wanted to be an atheist like my dad. I didn't want to believe in anything. But I wasn't sure what I believed anymore. That, and trying to get ghosts to cooperate, seemed far more reasonable than dealing with my coworkers. I asked my mom about her dowser friends.
Do you think any of them might be willing to do some ghost hunting? Maybe Steve could talk to the ghosts.
Steve, her aura reading and healing teacher, had given me lessons in dowsing the year before. My younger sister and I had gone to high school with Steve's kids. I knew from him that dowsing could be used to find things. I'd found my mom's lost keys with it once. If Steve said that there were no ghosts, it would be obvious that my coworkers were behind everything.
What a wonderful idea,
Mom said.
We could have a séance.
I considered not telling Bertha, since I was fairly certain she hated me already. I knew how she felt about ghosts. Or at least, I thought I did. She wasn't going to like the idea of psychics any better. That was a bridge I would have to cross when I came to it. We'd run out of toilet paper again at the Ermatinger house. I hung a sign on the door and went to the art gallery to get some of theirs. When I told Mandy why I was there, she flicked her long blonde hair over her shoulder.
I told Bertha last week, but she still hasn't bought any. I had to bring some from home today for the gallery and the children's museum. You can bring your own to your house.
When I asked my parents for toilet paper for work, my dad refused, going on a tirade about taxpayer money that was supposed to be funding my job. He wasn't going to pay for the museum's toilet paper twice. My mom snuck me a roll. She also told me that a dozen of her dowsing friends were interested in talking to the ghosts. I was thrilled. It would be the biggest tour I'd ever given. Of course, that meant I would also have to talk in front of 12 people. The idea left me a nervous wreck. But I wanted this job, and I wanted the historical homes to get business. I called Raj to tell him. He wanted to be there to see what they said. I would have an even larger audience. When Bertha finally came in to drop off the employee paychecks, I told her the news, that I had 12 people set up to go on an after-hours tour. She glared at me and told me that I wasn't getting paid to give after-hours tours. My shoulders sagged in disappointment. I could see that I needed to make a small sacrifice if it would help sustain my job in the long run. I told her I would do it off the clock. She asked if these were the people that Raj had told her about, the psychics. Her face pinched up like the word tasted dirty in her mouth. I hesitated and told her that some of them were dowsers. I was hoping she didn't know what that was. She gave me an abrupt
no. But it will bring in $60. We haven't had that many people book a tour all month.
Bertha said that the city's history needs to be preserved and treated with respect. That this museum will not be turned into some kind of freak show. I relented and trudged away. She spoke up again, her tone making me freeze. She pointed to the basement door, ajar once again, and asked me what I'd been told about keeping it closed. She said that it's a lawsuit waiting to happen if a person goes on a tour and falls down those stairs. What people? I wanted to ask. I told her that it was locked, trying to keep my temper in check. I didn't open the door, and I'm not the only person with keys. And besides that, ghosts didn't need keys. I told Raj over the phone that there would be no ghost tour. It wasn't even his day to work, but he drove right over. I could hear him shouting as I cleaned upstairs. He was the only person that I had ever heard raise his voice to my boss. I heard him shouting about how they're hurting for money. Bertha's tone was the cool monotone she often used with people she didn't like, namely me. In the end, Raj won, but not because Bertha caved in. He went to her supervisor, who vetoed her refusal to let a tour of paying customers take place. They said if the tour was successful, Raj could put on a ghost tour on Halloween. I didn't know what the definition of success was for a ghost tour, but we were about to find out. The evening before the tour began, Raj bubbled with enthusiasm. The fire department let him borrow special thermal goggles while the psychics were there. The goggles will detect any cold spots that might indicate paranormal activity, so he could see if it matches any of the spots they find. Raj giggled with giddy delight. I was pretty sure it wasn't going to take special goggles to tell us where the cold spots were. Anyone could feel them. It was dark and gloomy when my 12 tourists showed up. My body was taut with nervous excitement. Unlike the normal tours, where Raj or I gave the history of the house, we let the psychics lead us on the tour. Several of us held flashlights so we could see in the darkness. Since we weren't in the kitchen, the most modern part of the house with electricity, the rooms were eerily dark. Aside from the green light of the alarm unit on the front door, there were no other lights that came from the house itself. Steve walked through the house, instructing his dowsing students to hold out their hands and give their impressions. He was a big teddy bear of a guy, with a beard and a warm smile for everyone. He didn't look like a paranormal expert, whatever that was supposed to look like. Our special group was permitted to enter the display room where the cold spot was. I heard someone say that someone died in this room. Someone else said that she drowned. Raj looked up from his camera, eyes going wide. He mouthed the words to me. "Did you tell them?" I shook my head. A woman had died in the bathtub over 100 years before. Bertha didn't let us tell tourists about it. But somehow, the people in this group had sensed it. Someone walked straight over to the case with the pelican scissors.
"These were used to stab someone, but not here."
My eyes went wide. My mom patted my arm, a little smile on her face. I had told her about the scissors the day before. I wondered if she had mentioned it. Steve pointed to the scissors in the case, and he said that they weren't from the house. I looked to Raj for confirmation. He leaned over and whispered that everything in that case was an antique, but nothing was actually an artifact from this house. Some of the dowsers used L-shaped rods. Others used pendulums. Some preferred their hands to detect subtle energies. People gave their impressions, mostly things that couldn't be verified. Once in a while, they gave information that Raj said was true. I thought things were going well. Until Bertha showed up. I had no idea why she came skulking up the stairs to spy on us. Maybe just to make sure that the psychics weren't drawing pentagrams on the floor in blood. Raj nudged me and nodded to Bertha, hiding in the shadows. I tried to ignore her. By this point, Steve was summing up the presences he'd found. He said there were ghosts who visit the house, but only two are permanent residents. One is an older man, a sea captain. He has a spot by the window. He ordered everyone to turn off their lights. When they did, there was a place on the floor that was slightly brighter than the rest of the room.
not directly in front of the window, but just to the left, in the darkness. "Are you recording this?" I whispered to Raj, hoping he saw what I saw. He shushed me with a sassy wave of the hand. Steve strode out of the room, turning his flashlight on again. I turned mine on, too. Silly as it was, the light made me feel a small measure of reassurance. He gazed across the large landing where Bertha stood on the stairs. And then he raised his voice.
"There's a little girl here. She's the one who likes to play tricks. Her name is April."
He said she hadn't been there as long. When I turned to look at Bertha, her face was waxy and pale in the light of her flashlight. Steve pointed to the empty space beside Bertha. "She's standing right there." Bertha turned, slowly, gazing at the empty space beside her with wide eyes, looking like she wanted to say something, but couldn't bring herself to do it. I told the group that April is what I call the little girl ghost. I made up that name because I thought she needed a name. Steve smiled in his friendly, fatherly way. "You didn't make that name up. She told you the name. You just didn't realize it." Bertha's face went pale. After the unofficial tour, we gave the official tour, talking about the history of the house and telling ghost stories of our own. I was shocked when Bertha told us the stories about the man who had been confined to the house before hanging. She gave us the gory details about the sex worker who had been murdered in the bathtub and the drug-dealing caretaker who had been found screaming in the basement by the police. The caretaker had been screaming about the ghosts.
"But these are nice ghosts, right?"
I asked. Steve spoke up.
"April and the sea captain are benevolent spirits, but the flybys are the ones you have to watch out for. People don't have a personality transplant just because they die. Some of them aren't any nicer in death than they were in life."
Later, Raj and I reviewed the camera footage. It was dark and grainy because we'd filmed in the evening, and the only lights upstairs were our flashlights. On the tape, we couldn't see the cold spot that had been brighter than the rest of the room, and the audio was horrible. Our footsteps on wooden floors sounded like elephants. When it was really quiet, I couldn't tell if that was a scratch, scratch, scratch I was hearing, or just the rustle of clothes. Raj interviewed himself wearing his special heat goggles, but he hadn't been able to record what he'd seen. Thinking of the scratching, I asked Raj if he'd let me make a copy of the tape. My mom has a friend with a machine that plays audio backwards. Sometimes our voices say things we don't know, little messages that you can hear in reverse. He was completely on board. After all, maybe there would be ghost voices. Once I got a copy, my mom's friend, Gloria, played the VHS and recorded the backward version for me. The backward versions of what everyone said was garbled and alien-sounding. If you listened hard, you could sometimes catch phrases like,
"I don't know shit,"
or
"I just made that up."
Most of these I couldn't hear on my own. I could only decipher it when Gloria pointed them out to me. She explained that when playing speech backward, you're most likely to hear something if it's full of emotion. People will either agree with themselves or reveal something you don't expect. When we got to Bertha's voice playing backward, that was the most interesting. She was talking about the little girl. I didn't need Gloria to decipher her words for me. Bertha's backward voice was clear. Bertha said, "She's my daughter." Gloria and I didn't listen to the entire recording she made. It was 2 hours long. But Raj and I did. We ate popcorn in the art gallery's coffee shop, listening to the recording together. We had fun, trying to hear hidden messages, rewinding and replaying the backward speech. It was almost like a date, except that 5 of my coworkers were there, including the ones I didn't like. Their negative commentary constantly interrupted the clues we were listening for.
"This is stupid. Those psychics could have looked any of this up ahead of time in a history book. And this lady who made the tape for you might have planted the audio over your original recording. She's just trying to freak us out."
At least Dottie was quiet while she was making out with her boyfriend on the coffee shop couch. As we listened to the conversation, a whispery voice said over everything, "Scratch, scratch, scratch." It was so faint, I didn't know if I'd heard it. Raj jumped up, popcorn spilling all over the wood floor. He asked if we'd heard it. I wrapped my arms around myself. Everyone else could hear it too.
"Who the hell said that?"
"I don't know."
I rewound and played it again. The same voice. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Every muscle in my body was tight with trepidation. Raj had an idea. He asked what was being played in the regular version, when the audio was normal. I told him I couldn't check it. It was a separate recording. He found the same spot on the camera, where the video was still moving forward in time. We listened. There were noises in the background, clothes rustling, feet tapping across the floor, and conversations in the other room as people talked about dowsing.
"I'm going home. This is freaking me out."
Dottie looked to her boyfriend, Bertha's son, who had claimed early on that it was all fake. He'd never had a sister named April, so he didn't believe any of it. But he wanted to keep listening. It was kind of cool, he said.
"No, it's not."
Dottie clenched her fists, glowering at me as though it was my fault her boyfriend liked the recording. I grinned, like this was the greatest triumph of my life. We were glued to the tape player, listening for more secret messages in reverse. It was near the end of the recording that Raj had recorded Bertha's conversation with Steve. They were talking about the history of the building when we heard it again. Scratch, scratch, scratch.
"I want to go home."
Raj told me to play it again. With shaking hands, I did so. In the reverse recording, a man said, "I want to be seen."
"Who said that?"
The words were clear. We played it and replayed it, trying to figure out whose voice it was. Raj had to fast forward through his recording to find the same spot. When he played the video, Bertha had commented on not wanting the ghost tours to be a public thing. Voices of some of the other dowsers came from the other room. A car revved its engine in the background, faint but distinct. The floor creaked under the weight of feet. No one had been talking at all. It was a voice out of nothing. Raj looked at me. The ghosts wanted to be seen. They wanted to be heard. At least, that's what he thought. I guess that was one way of interpreting it. The first ghost tour was deemed a success. In the coming months, Raj would go on to host Halloween events. He told tales of historical ghosts, single-handedly making up for a slow summer of non-existent tourism.
Several more months passed. In early November, the sun set at 5 o'clock because of daylight savings time. It cast the house in gloomy shadows. Even though I knew that the ghosts were benevolent, it still creeped me out to be in the house when it was dark. Dottie came in with Mandy while I was locking up, which was unusual since they usually left the art gallery right after work. Mandy held up her Bible.
Don't mind us. We're just going to exorcise the ghosts.
I was dumbstruck.
What? Why?
They need to go to heaven? We need to help them. It's the right thing to do.
You can't light candles in here. This is a historic building. What if something catches on fire?
Dottie rolled her eyes.
Relax. The fire department is next door.
What if there isn't a heaven? What if you're just evicting them out of their home and forcing them into nothingness?
I didn't care if these girls hated me for standing up to them. It wasn't like I was going to be invited to the cool club if I held my tongue. These ghosts wanted to be heard and to be remembered. I could empathize with that. Forcing these spirits out with an exorcism was like pouring salt on their wounds. Mandy crossed her arms.
The only thing I'm going to force is your mouth closed if you don't shut up.
I wanted to go home and get ready for classes at the community college the next day. But I also didn't want to be irresponsible and leave the historical house with these two and get blamed for anything they did. I waited downstairs as they lit their candles and prayed for the souls of the ghosts. I heard them saying, "Go toward the light." From down here, at the bottom of the stairs, I whispered,
"You don't have to go toward the light. Not unless you want to."
I was still there, wishing that Raj hadn't invited them to watch the video with us, or to listen to the reverse audio. A few minutes later, we headed to the door as a unit. I tried setting the alarm, but the red light blinked. The control panel wouldn't let me set it. Dottie rolled her eyes.
Ugh, there's a door open somewhere. Or a window.
No, everything's closed. I'd already checked it before you got here. What did you touch when you came in?
I crossed my arms, not willing to let them pass the blame to me. Dottie snapped her fingers at me.
Go upstairs. Mandy and I will check the kitchen and dining room.
I should have been thankful they were willing to check the building at all with me. All I could think about was how they stayed together while I was stuck going upstairs all alone. About how there was a traveling cold spot up there. I checked every window, not expecting them to be open. At the top of the stairs, I found dripped candle wax on the floor that I scraped off with my fingernails so Bertha wouldn't find it. Dottie and Mandy waited at the door, conspiring in whispers. I didn't trust them.
If you don't hurry up, we're gonna leave without you.
I stomped down the stairs. The red light was still blinking.
I checked everything. All of the windows are closed and locked.
I glowered at them. It had to be the ghosts. They were angry about the exorcism, and now I was the one getting punished. Dottie huffed.
Well, obviously, you didn't do a very good job checking.
She nodded to Mandy, and they went upstairs. I really didn't want to go into the kitchen and check the back door to find a ghost standing there, or Dottie's boyfriend, waiting there to jump out at me. But I forced myself not to hyperventilate. I used my flashlight to check all of the windows and the door. Everything was closed. Everything was locked. The three of us met again at the keypad, and it was still blinking red.
Wait a minute. You said go toward the light when you were doing your little exorcism.
Yeah, so?
This is the only light that was on in the house.
But we didn't mean that light.
Dottie shouted.
Hey, ghosts! Not this light! Don't go toward this light!
As their laughter died away into silence, we looked to the alarm light in expectation. Behind me, I heard a soft scratch, scratch, scratch. Goosebumps rose on my arms. Then, a creak came from the dining room. The basement door slowly creaked open. All three of us screamed and ran out of the house. I practically jumped off the porch. I didn't feel better until I was on the sidewalk.
You have to set the alarm. It's your shift.
I don't want to go back in there. I wouldn't even be here if you hadn't come in before I closed.
It sucks to be you.
Mandy smoothed her hair, attempting to look like she hadn't almost peed her pants.
I guess the basement door was open.
Dottie gave me a fake smile.
All you have to do is shut it, and then you can set the alarm.
I had to go back in alone? What if it wasn't one of the nice ghosts in there? What if it was one of the visitor ghosts that Steve had mentioned? I walked up the steps of the porch and stood outside the door, trying to build up the nerve to go back inside. I started whispering desperately under my breath.
Please close the basement door. Please close the basement door so that I can set the alarm.
I opened the door, stepped back, and stared into the darkness. Nothing moved. My eyes adjusted to the lack of light. I poked my head in, saw no one, and ran forward and flashed my light at the basement door. It was closed. I didn't know if that was good or bad. I closed the front door and checked the alarm. The light was green. When I set the alarm, it beeped to tell me that I had a few more seconds to leave and lock the door. I did. I spotted my coworkers in their cars across the street as I came out. For what it's worth, I will never tell a ghost to go toward the light. After moving on from that job, I had no intention of working at another historical home again. Not because I was afraid of ghosts, but I just thought I deserved more than minimum wage to put up with coworkers like Dottie and Mandy. And yet, 24 years later, I found myself working at a historical home once again, though in a very different capacity. I was teaching a writing summer camp in Eugene, Oregon, at the Shelton McMurphy Johnson House. It was a beautiful Victorian that captured the essence of Gothic ghost stories with its creaky wooden stairs and antique furniture. My teacher orientation reminded me of all those times I was scared out of my skin. Maybe those supposed spirits had all been in my imagination. The idea of teaching in another historic home was what made me search for the box of videotapes. I found the unedited version that hadn't made it into Raj's final film. It took more excavations to find my old VCR. I tried to watch the video, but it had been stored in a hot attic for years. It was unwatchable. Somehow, the cassette tape Gloria had recorded had survived. I listened, picking up at the same spot we'd left off all those years ago.
Scratch, scratch, scratch.
A whispery voice said,
I want to be heard.
The shock of hearing those voices again sent a jolt of icy trepidation through my core. Every dark shadow in my house pressed ominously against me. There was no way I could listen to more, especially at night if I wanted to sleep. I turned it off. Even after all these years, those recordings freaked me out. I did a Google search for Raj's name. I wasn't completely surprised to find him on the cover of some kind of haunted history magazine, dressed in period attire. He'd gotten grayer. He wasn't the skinny young man I remembered. But he was just as flamboyant. I could see why my mom had tried to delicately suggest he'd never be interested in me. It had nothing to do with me being a wallflower. I sent Raj a message through Facebook. "Hey, Raj. I hope you're doing well. I saw that you're still giving ghost tours. The next time I'm in Oregon City visiting family, it would be great to get a coffee with you and visit." His message was almost instant. He wrote, "Who are you?" I thought he had to be joking. "We worked together at the Ermatinger house." He wrote back, "I worked for the city for 30 years, and I've met a lot of people. Can you give me a little more information?" I couldn't imagine him not remembering me. He had been such an important part of my life. We went to high school together. He took me on a tour of PNCA, where I later went to school. My dad helped him with an engineering blueprint for his graphic design thesis. We'd gone to see the Blair Witch Project with our coworkers. 20 years before, when Raj had become an art teacher, he'd hired me to photograph his students for a self-portrait project. But I just wrote, "We gave the first haunted tour together, with the psychics." He didn't respond. Apparently, he had no idea who I was. It was such a letdown. After all these years, I still felt the impact of those ghosts and what a creepy experience it had been working in the Ermatinger house and how Raj had been part of that. "I want to be seen," the ghost had said. "I want to be heard." I could relate. I had been forgotten by a close friend while the dead had lived on in Raj's ghost tours. I went to the summer camp and taught my lessons. For someone who used to barely be able to lead one or two people on a tour, public speaking was now second nature. I'd gotten over my fear of talking to groups, probably in part because of all that practice I'd done as a tour guide. During the tour of the house that the manager took us on, I admired the artifacts and display cases and the paintings of the deceased. I thought of my yearning to be remembered as a talented artist. Such fantasies were replaced by the reality of how fleeting our existence really was. I wasn't destined to be a rich and famous artist, or a rich and famous writer, or a teacher. But as someone educating the children of the future, I didn't want to steal this dream from my students yet. One of the 11-year-old girls asked if there are any ghosts in this building. A 12-year-old boy leaned forward with interest, asking if anyone ever died in the house.
"No one has died inside the house,"
the manager said firmly.
"The official story is that there are no spirits here. My supervisor doesn't approve of us promoting ghost stories."
This was a familiar scenario. I imagined her supervisor could easily have been friends with Bertha.
"But unofficially?"
I prompted.
"Have you felt the presence of ghosts?"
A sly smile spread over the manager's face. The students were riveted. Their imagination sparked. I could tell what they'd be writing about in summer camp. I listened to the manager's explanation, wandering out of the stuffy room to a cooler place in the hallway. That's when I heard it. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Chills pricked up my spine. It looked like there was still room for more ghost stories in my life. Even if it was my fate to live and die in obscurity, perhaps I could help these ghosts be remembered.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of 13. If you like what you heard, stop what you're doing and leave a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. This was Scratch, Scratch, Scratch by Serena Dori. Narrated by me, Brooke Jeanette. Dottie was Kayla Temshev. Mandy was Carly Coulihan. Music composed by Kayla Ritchie. Editing and sound design by Brooke Jeanette. Additional assistance from Bridget Freeman and Ian Epperson. Our producer-level patrons are Rick Linville, Tattooed Fox, Rhiannon, Sean Geary, Anthony Diaz, Michael Vasquez, Amy Harper, Jackie Kay, Delta Tango, Chantel Payne, Nick, Emily Douglas, Stephanie Klinger, Jake R., and Abigail Perez. Thank you so much for your support. Click the link in the show notes to learn more about joining us on Patreon. Check us out on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok under Pod13. And you can join the Facebook group for 13 Podcast. Just look for our logo. You'll find links in the show notes. If you'd like to submit a story to be performed on the show, or if you'd like to contact us about anything else, get in touch at info@13podcast.com. You'll find submission guidelines and other info on our website, 13podcast.com. You can find that in the show notes, too.
Bridget Freeman is scratching at the door.
Thanks for listening.
Edgar said to the interviewer he was convinced that the thing out there wasn't a vault.
Yeah, I know what he thought.
Dr. Edgars didn't think it was designed to keep things out.
I know what he thought.
It was designed to keep something in.
Do you even understand the difficulty trying to keep a base like Fathom at the bottom of the ocean from killing everyone in it on a daily basis?
Oh my God.
Everyone hold on to something.
I think whatever is on the other side of that door out there, it's not friendly. I think it's trying to get out. That, my friend, is a dire combination.
That's a bad sign.
Get out of the door!
It's spreading like some kind of technological contagion. We can either stop it here or watch the world burn.
Fathom, the first season of Derelict. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or learn more at DerelictPodcast.com.